College English Test Band 4 Part 2 Listening Comprehension
Section A Directions In this section, you will hear 8 short conversations and 2 long conversations. At the end of each conversation, one or more questions will be asked about what was said. Both the conversation and the questions will be spoken only once. After each question, there will be a pause. During the pause, you must read the 4 choices marked A, B, C, and D, and decide which is the best answer. Then, mark the corresponding letter on answer sheet 1 with a single line through the center. Now, let's begin with the 8 short conversations. Question 1. I don't know what to do with Timmy. This morning I found orange juice spilled all over the kitchen floor.
Don't be so hard on him. He's only 4.
What does the woman mean?
Question 2.
Excuse me, sir, I would like to know about the fitness training program in your club.
I'll have you speak with the director in charge of new accounts.
What is the woman interested in?
Question 3. It's really cold in this apartment. Can we turn up the heat a little bit?
Sorry, I've run out of money and can hardly pay the fuel bill. Maybe you'd better put on a sweater.
What does the man mean?
Question 4. I'm sorry, miss, but you have to come with me to the security office. The video cameras in our shop have recorded everything you did.
No, I didn't do anything. I'll call the police if you dare insult me.
What does the man think the woman was doing? Question 5. I think you ought to see a doctor right away about that cough.
Well, I'll wait a few more days. I'm sure I'll get over it soon.
What do we learn about the woman? Question 6. I've heard that Pamela made quite a few mistakes in her lab report.
Well, she wouldn't have if she hadn't been in such a hurry to get it done.
What does the woman imply? Question 7. We'd better check out before 12 o'clock, Mary, and now there are only 30 minutes left.
Let's hurry up. You go pay the bill, and I'll call the reception to have our luggage taken downstairs.
Where did this conversation most probably take place?
Question 8. Have you ever heard this speaker before?
Yeah, she's excellent. She gets her point across and is entertaining at the same time.
What does the man say about the speaker?
Now you'll hear the two long conversations. Conversation 1. What should I do about Mr. Romero? Remember? He said it was important and couldn't wait. I think he may want you for the next movie he's directing.
That's absolutely correct. Now we have to fit him in somewhere. What does Monday morning look like?
That doesn't look so good. You have a makeup session starting at 6 o'clock. Then filming starts at 8 o'clock, and that's going to take the whole morning.
Well, what's after that?
You have lunch with your agent to discuss the awards ceremony, and you ought to meet him at 1 o'clock at the restaurant.
Oh, terrific. Listen, I cannot miss that. But I still have to make time for Mr. Romero.
Well, now, don't forget you've got a 3 o'clock appointment with your fashion designer.
That's right. You know he's showing the latest fashions from Japan? You know that loose-fitting look? Those clothes are on show this year.
At 4:30, you have an appointment with your hairdresser. Then, at 7 o'clock, you have dinner with a journalist. Now, remember, be nice to that guy.
Do I have to? That won't be easy. And it's likely to run late. How does Tuesday look?
Well, you have to spend the whole morning at the photographer's. They are taking photos to publicize your new movie.
What about the afternoon? Am I free then?
Let me see. Yes, you are free after 3:30.
Then you can set up a meeting with Mr. Romero at 4.
Okay, I'll get on it right away. Questions 9 to 11 are based on the conversation you have just heard. Question 9. What are the speakers doing? Question 10. What is the woman going to discuss with her agent over lunch on Monday? Question 11. What do we learn from the conversation about the man?
Conversation 2.
I'm phoning up about this job you advertise in this paper, this, young sales manager?
Oh, yes.
I'd like to apply for it. Would you send me an application form?
No, you simply send in a written application, a letter.
Can you tell me a bit more about the job?
Well, we are really looking for someone who isn't too concerned about working fairly long hours.
What do you mean by long hours?
This is a job which does, as the advertisement says, have travel possibilities, and very often one would be away at weekends, for instance.
Oh, I thought you meant working in the evenings and working overtime.
Well, it could also mean working in the evenings, but for a managerial post, I'm afraid we don't pay overtime. That's for other grades.
Oh, what kind of money are you paying then?
Well, this is to be negotiated. Oh, it depends partly on your experience and education. Perhaps you can tell me briefly what that is?
I've just left school and got A-level in geography.
Oh, I see.
And it's the travel that appeals to me. That's why I'm inquiring about the job.
Yes, I see. What sort of salary were you thinking in terms of?
Starting off, I thought it would be something like £500 a week.
Well, send in a written application, and then we'll consider your case along with all the other applicants.
All right. Many thanks. Goodbye.
Bye. Questions 12 to 15 are based on the conversation you have just heard. Question 12. What does the woman say an applicant should do first to apply for the job? Question 13. What kind of a person is the company looking for? Question 14. What does the man like most about the job? Question 15. What does the woman say about the salary if the man is accepted by the company? Section B. Directions. In this section, you will hear three short passages. At the end of each passage, you will hear some questions. Both the passage and the questions will be spoken only once. After you hear a question, you must choose the best answer from the four choices marked A, B, C, and D. Then mark the corresponding letter on answer sheet 1 with a single line through the center.
Passage 1. A typical large supermarket offers around 17,000 to 20,000 items for sale, and it wants to make sure that its customers see as many of them as possible. That's why you'll only find essential goods like bread, vegetables, and meat in completely different parts of the store. Products with a high profit margin are always placed on shelves within easy reach of the customer, while lower margin items like sugar or flour are on the top or bottom shelves. Many people make shopping lists before they visit supermarkets. But even so, around 60% of all supermarket purchases are the result of decisions that are taken in the store. For this reason, supermarkets try to attract their customers by placing certain kinds of products next to each other. In the UK, beer will often be found next to items for babies because research shows that fathers of babies buy them on their way home from work and will buy beer at the same time. Research has also shown that this kind of impulse buy happens more frequently when no sales assistants are nearby. Supermarkets have made selling such a fine art that their customers often lose all sense of time. When interviewed, customers normally guess they've only spent half an hour in the supermarket, even when they have been there for over 45 minutes. But that shouldn't be too surprising. Any witty, profitable supermarket knows that it should keep its clocks well hidden.
Questions 16 to 19 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 16. Why are essential goods displayed in totally different parts of the supermarket? Question 17. Where are goods with a high profit margin usually found? Question 18. What does the speaker say about the supermarket goers? Question 19. What shouldn't be too surprising, according to the speaker? Passage 2. When Maddie Sallin was working on a degree in arts and technology at university, he got an interesting assignment in electronics class. Create something for the household. He decided to create an alarm clock. Everybody has to use an alarm clock of some kind every day, and it's extremely unpleasant, he says. He asked different people what they'd like to wake up to instead of a noisy alarm. A lot of them said the smell of bacon. So Sallin invented a new kind of alarm clock. A wooden box with a pig face and a digital clock that uses the smell of cooking bacon, rather than sound, to wake someone up. He explains, "There's no danger of burning because I built it carefully. It uses light bulbs instead of a flame for cooking and turns off automatically after 10 minutes. Just a few easy steps are required to set the alarm. What you do is put in a couple of frozen strips the night before," says Salen. "Bacon is preserved, so there is no danger of it spoiling overnight. If you set the alarm for 8 o'clock, it will turn on at 7:50 and slow cook for 10 minutes under the bulbs," he says. "Then the bulbs turn off and a fan blows the smell out through the nose of the pig. So instead of an alarm, you smell yourself awake," says Salen. "Then you can open the door on the side and pull the bacon out and eat it."
Questions 20 to 22 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 20. What was Matti Salen doing when he created an alarm clock? Question 21. What did Matti Salen do before making the new type of alarm clock? Question 22. What makes the newly invented alarm clock so unique? Passage 3. Most people feel lonely sometimes, but it usually only lasts between a few minutes and a few hours. For some people, though, loneliness can last for years. Psychologists are studying this complex phenomenon and have identified three different types of loneliness. The first kind of loneliness is temporary. It usually disappears quickly and does not require any special attention. The second kind, situational loneliness, is a natural result of a particular situation, for example, a divorce or moving to a new place. Although this kind of loneliness can cause physical problems, it usually does not last for more than a year. Unlike the second type, the third kind of loneliness usually lasts more than 2 years and has no specific cause. People who experience habitual loneliness have problems socializing and becoming close to others. Unfortunately, many of them think there is little or nothing they can do about it. Psychologists agree that one important factor in loneliness is a person's social contacts, for example, friends, family members, etc. We depend on various people for different reasons. For instance, our families give us emotional support, and our friends share similar interests and activities. However, psychologists have found that the number of social contacts we have is not the only reason for loneliness. It is more important how many social contacts we think or expect we should have. In other words, though lonely people may have many social contacts, they sometimes feel they should have more. They question their own popularity.
Questions 23 to 25 are based on the passage you have just heard. Question 23. What does the speaker say about situational loneliness? Question 24. What problem will people have if they experience habitual loneliness? Question 25. Why do some people suffer loneliness according to psychologists? Section C. Directions. In this section, you will hear a passage three times. When the passage is read for the first time, you should listen carefully for its general idea. When the passage is read for the second time, you are required to fill in the blanks with the exact words you have just heard. Finally, when the passage is read for the third time, you should check what you have written. Now, listen to the passage. There was a time when any personal information that was gathered about us was typed on a piece of paper and locked away in a file cabinet. It could remain there for years and, often forgotten, never reach the outside world. Things have done a complete about-face since then. Responsible for the change has been the astonishingly swift development in recent years of the computer. Today, any data that is collected about us in one place or another, and for one reason or another, can be stored in a computer bank. It can then be easily passed to other computer banks. They are owned by individuals and by private businesses and corporations, lending institutions, direct mailing and telemarketing firms, credit bureaus, credit card companies, and government agencies at the local, state, and federal level. A growing number of Americans are seeing the accumulation and distribution of computerized data as a frightening invasion of their privacy. Surveys show that the number of worried Americans has been steadily growing over the years as the computer becomes increasingly efficient, easier to operate, and less costly to purchase and maintain. In 1970, a national survey showed that 37% of the people questioned felt their privacy was being invaded. 7 years later, 47% expressed the same worry. A recent survey by a credit bureau revealed that the number of alarmed citizens had soared up to 76%. Now the passage will be read again.
There was a time when any personal information that was gathered about us was typed on a piece of paper and locked away in a file cabinet. It could remain there for years and, often forgotten, never reach the outside world. Things have done a complete about-face since then. Responsible for the change has been the astonishingly swift development in recent years of the computer. Today, any data that is collected about us in one place or another, and for one reason or another, can be stored in a computer bank. It can then be easily passed to other computer banks. They are owned by individuals and by private businesses and corporations, lending institutions, direct mailing and telemarketing firms, credit bureaus, credit card companies, and government agencies at the local, state, and federal level. A growing number of Americans are seeing the accumulation and distribution of computerized data as a frightening invasion of their privacy. Surveys show that the number of worried Americans has been steadily growing over the years as the computer becomes increasingly efficient, easier to operate, and less costly to purchase and maintain. In 1970, a national survey showed that 37% of the people questioned felt their privacy was being invaded. 7 years later, 47% expressed the same worry. A recent survey by a credit bureau revealed that the number of alarmed citizens had soared up to 76%.
Now the passage will be read for the third time. There was a time when any personal information that was gathered about us was typed on a piece of paper and locked away in a file cabinet. It could remain there for years and, often forgotten, never reach the outside world. Things have done a complete about-face since then. Responsible for the change has been the astonishingly swift development in recent years of the computer. Today, any data that is collected about us in one place or another, and for one reason or another, can be stored in a computer bank. It can then be easily passed to other computer banks. They are owned by individuals and by private businesses and corporations, lending institutions, direct mailing and telemarketing firms, credit bureaus, credit card companies, and government agencies at the local, state, and federal level. A growing number of Americans are seeing the accumulation and distribution of computerized data as a frightening invasion of their privacy. Surveys show that the number of worried Americans has been steadily growing over the years as the computer becomes increasingly efficient, easier to operate, and less costly to purchase and maintain. In 1970, A national survey showed that 37% of the people questioned felt their privacy was being invaded. 7 years later, 47% expressed the same worry. A recent survey by a credit bureau revealed that the number of alarmed citizens had soared up to 76%. This is the end of listening comprehension.